It's incredible, really, isn't it, reading through the book of Genesis, and particularly when you come to Jacob's story. Here was a man whom God had chosen. He was not the firstborn. He was not the one who, by the standards of the day, would naturally have been the recipient of blessings and honour. But he was God's chosen. He was a man full of trickery and deceit. He was a man who, in many ways, is someone that we would not want to emulate. And yet he is God's chosen. And the unfolding story of his life is really one of bitterness, of sadness, of family infighting. It could not have been a happy life. Perhaps we would say, well, he reaped what he sowed. And had he been more inclined to trust the Lord as a young man, trust the promises of God that his older brother would serve him, rather than taking matters into his own hands, if he had trusted that the Lord in his sovereignty would have granted him the blessing and promise of Abraham, rather than deceitfully taking it by his own wisdom. Perhaps if he had done those things differently, he would not have reaped the whirlwind that was to follow. And certainly we can see consequences to those earlier actions. And we can observe that even God's chosen ones are not immune from the consequences of their sins. Their sins may not lead to ultimate death, separation from God for eternity, but nevertheless, their sins can lead to all kinds of temporal frustrations and problems. And this is very much the case in Jacob's family. What a family it is. And what a chapter it is that we've read together this evening. A story of rivalry, of plottings, of tradings. It's quite incredible, really, the things that went on. And isn't it amazing that God extends his love and mercy to such people? Such people as Leah, who rejoiced in the fruitfulness of her womb at the expense of her sister Rachel. That God should extend his love to someone like Rachel, who showed such bitterness. That God should extend his love to someone like Jacob, who over and over again just seems to go along with his wife's wishes in this chapter, never seeming to put in a word of correction or advice or guidance, nor even, it would seem, leading the way in terms of taking the problems and difficulties and disgrace to the Lord in prayer. It wasn't that they didn't have any examples. No doubt he had heard his own parents' story and how his own mother had been barren and how they had prayed to the Lord and the Lord had answered their prayer after many, many years. How his own grandmother at an old age had borne a son. Oh, it isn't that they're without example. It seems that they're just so preoccupied with themselves that God is left on the periphery of their lives, even though they are of the promised line, the line of blessing, the line of Abraham and Isaac. Isn't it wonderful that God overrules to bring about his purposes? That despite all the wheeling and dealing of this chapter, despite the sibling rivalry that would put the arguments of four-year-olds to shame, despite all of that, God overrules. God continues to work out his purposes, and through it all, and in spite of it all, God fulfills his promises to Abraham and to Isaac that were reiterated to Jacob. After all, this is just one little episode in the story of the promised Redeemer. This story is not about Jacob. This story is not about Leah and Rachel. This story is not about Reuben, Levi, Judah, Dan, and Naphtali, and the others. This story is about Jesus. Oh, it's just 2 pages in a book of 1,000 or more. But it's about him. It's his story. And that's where God's focus is, even when people like Jacob and Leah and Rachel are so wrapped up in themselves that they forget the bigger picture. God never forgets that. He is working out his purposes despite the sinfulness of the people that he has chosen to participate in the story. It's a wonderful reminder to us that in our own lives, God is at work, and the way that we respond to the circumstances of our lives will not necessarily cause God to turn from us. The story of the Redeemer doesn't look very hopeful in the midst of this passage, but God ensures that hope is never lost. On the eve of entering the promised land, the Israelites would have been considering this story. Moses has penned it for them. They have been wandering in the wilderness for 40 years, and during that time, Moses has made this record of their history. Wonder what they thought as these verses were read out for them. This is their heritage. These are their roots. This is how their tribal identities began. Wonder what sort of embarrassing feelings entered their hearts. But it's a story that reminds them about God, about the kind of God that has brought them out of Egypt, the kind of God who has led them by a pillar of cloud during the day and fire at night for 40 years, and has brought them to the banks of the Jordan, to the plains of Moab, from which they will soon depart to cross the river to enter the land that had been promised to Abraham. It's a story which reminds them of who they are, of the kind of people that they are, the blood that runs through their veins, and how they ought to be, and where their focus ought to be. Three things they will learn from this story of their ancestry. Three things about God. One is that their God is a compassionate God. Their God is a compassionate God. Leah was hated. I know that some commentators try to downplay the weight of the language here. He loved Rachel more than Leah. But the idea is one of contrast here. Not that he loved Rachel more and he loved Leah less, but he loved Rachel and not Leah. In fact, Leah feels herself hated. And we see that over and over again in this story. It's introduced to us with the fact that the Lord saw that Leah was hated. She speaks herself about being hated. She has this longing that her husband will be attached to her, will honor her, will acknowledge her. He does his duty, but it seems that there is little more than that. And in a sense, it's understandable. After all, she played an active part in the deception of Jacob. When Laban, her father, tricked him into marrying his eldest daughter rather than the younger daughter for whom he had worked for 7 years. You can understand Jacob's feelings towards Leah, can't you, under such circumstances? I mean, not a word from her lips all night long to indicate that she was not Rachel, but Leah. She went along with the plan. And Jacob hated her as a result. But the Lord shows compassion towards her and opens her womb while Rachel is barren. Leah conceives and conceives again and conceives again. And conceives again. And we read through this passage and it's all over and done with in a few minutes. But years are passing here, naturally. We tend to forget that. Years of barrenness for the beautiful Rachel. Years of fruitfulness for the despised and hated Leah. God is showing compassion to Leah. God shows compassion to Rachel too. How many years have gone by? 4 sons born to Leah, 2 to Bilhah, 2 to Zilpah, another 2 to Leah, and a daughter, and Rachel still barren. At last, we're told that God remembered Rachel. It's not that he has forgotten her. The language of God remembering is the language that indicates that he is about to act in a particular situation. And God listened to her and opened her womb. And she conceived and bore a son. Yes, this is a compassionate God. He is the one who sees the suffering, being hated, being despised because you haven't lived up to the expectations of the day in bearing children in the home. Whatever it may be, God is a God who sees. A God who feels for us. A God who ministers to us. He is a compassionate God. We see it in the life of Jesus, don't we? He is the exact representation of God. He is God incarnate. And over again in the Gospels, we read of how Jesus had compassion on the sick, He had compassion on the downtrodden. He had compassion on the outcasts of society. He had compassion on children. He had compassion on the elderly. He had compassion on sinners. He was a man of compassion. And it was his compassion for sinners that ultimately took him to the cross, that he should bear our sins in his own body on that cross, so that we might be freed from the condemnation that we deserved for our iniquities. That is the extent of the compassion of God, that he would humble himself and become a man so that he could lift us out of the slough of our sinfulness into the very presence of his glory in heaven forever. He is a compassionate God. Another thing that we learn from this story is that this God is a long-suffering God. He doesn't give up with these people, does he? And find another way. No, he bears with them. Despite the obvious lack of regard for him in these people's lives, despite their self-obsession, he bears with them. He suffers long. Throughout this story, though God is present, he's barely present in the minds of these people. There's a sense in which we get the idea that at least for Rachel, and possibly for Leah as well, though that's more questionable, there's a growing sense of a need for God and a dependence on God and an acknowledgement of God. Leah often mentions God, but it always seems to be in the sense of getting one up on Rachel. Whereas the 22nd verse of chapter 30 implies that Rachel has learned the lesson that she needs to call on the name of the Lord. She should have done it to begin with, shouldn't she? She should have followed her mother-in-law's example. And when she realized she was barren, cried out to the Lord and continued to cry out to the Lord, and not followed her grandmother's example that had brought such bitterness into the lives of Abraham and Sarah when she had given her servant to be a concubine for Abraham, that through her they might have children. Now, at last, Rachel seems to have learned, and she cries out to the Lord, and God listened to her and opens her womb. But years have passed. With all this infighting and bitterness and cruel words and trading with one another and all the ugliness of this family situation. But God has been a long-suffering God. He's been patient. This is a lesson that Israel will learn firsthand as they enter the promised land and as they begin, by God's blessing, to establish themselves there and then shift from dependence upon God to a kind of self-determining approach to life, and begin to neglect God and even to reject God at times, God will prove himself over and over and over again to be a long-suffering God. Because God has a bigger picture in view. God has a people that he intends to save. And he has lessons that he intends to teach. And all of that comes through the choices that we make in our lives, and through his response to those in chastening us, in testing us, in providing for us. God is a long-suffering God. How thankful we should be for that. We look at this story and we can see so clearly the folly in it. But we don't see our own folly quite so clearly, do we? And perhaps years pass before we realize that certain attitudes that we had, certain words that we spoke, certain things that we did were far from what they ought to have been. But God is long-suffering with us. And he forgives us. And he works out his purposes in our lives. God is a long-suffering God. And then, of course, we learn that God is a sovereign God. He's a sovereign God. He's in control. Even in this sad situation. You see it perhaps most clearly in the story of Reuben's mandrakes. Mandrakes were a plant that grew that were considered to be a remedy for infertility, which is why, you understand, Rachel is so keen to have these mandrakes that Reuben has found in the field. And we also realize why it is that Leah is so determined that she shouldn't have them. In fact, Leah's language is interesting, isn't it? Is it a small matter that you've taken away my husband? Who took away whose husband? Wasn't it Rachel that was supposed to have married Jacob? Wasn't it Leah who stole away Rachel's husband? Would you take away my son's mandrakes also? Well, Rachel doesn't argue the point. But she trades for them. What is she trying to do? Well, she's trying to overcome her infertility. But it's not mandrakes that are going to cure her infertility. It's God. God is sovereign. It is God who opened Leah's womb and allowed her to conceive four sons, one after another. It was God who ensured that Rachel was barren for all these years. It is God who eventually opens Rachel's womb. God is sovereign in all of this. He is the one who gives life. He is the one who takes life. And the Israelites on the brink of entering into the promised land need to remember that right from their very beginning, God has been sovereign. That these 12 tribes have been formed out of the sovereign dealings of God. And he has preserved them through not just decades, but centuries. And that including slavery in Egypt. He has brought them out in remarkable ways that these Israelites, you would have thought, would have learned through the miracles that they have seen, and yet over and over again in 40 years of wandering in the wilderness, they forget, they complain, they question God's care of them, love for them, provision for them. And here they are on the brink of entering the promised land. They've been here before, slightly different location, but nevertheless on the borders of the promised land. And the last time they doubted God. They didn't believe that God could give them the land. They turned away from it, having listened to the 10 doubting spies and the stories that they told of giants and impregnable cities. And now they hear the story of their history and the God who, from the beginning of creation, has been working out his purposes in the world. A God who chose their forefather Abraham from Ur of the Chaldees out of all the nations of the world to make a special nation of his people. They've heard the story of God's grace in Abraham's life and in Isaac's life and then in Jacob's life. And here they are, the descendants of these 12 sons, that are described in this chapter. And they're on the brink of entering the promised land, and this time they must follow through. They must trust this sovereign God. They must trust the one who has provided and will provide. He is a sovereign God. And so there are these three things that they learn about this God. He's a compassionate God. He's a long-suffering God. And he's a sovereign God. And they learn two important responses that they must give to that, and that we must give to these truths. That this compassionate, long-suffering, and sovereign God is a God to be trusted. He will do what is right and good. It took Rachel a long time, it would seem. Years passed before she trusted this God. It's only right at the end that she uses the covenant name of God, the special name unique to the God of Abraham. Up until that, she uses the more generic Adonai. Now she uses the word Yahweh. May the Lord add to me another son. A hint that Benjamin is on the way, though he's not mentioned in this list of names. He's a God to be trusted. He's a God of faithfulness. He is a God of promise. He is Yahweh, the covenant-keeping God. And she's tried everything that she could. She's tried her servant. She's tried the mandrakes, all to no avail. It's not until she cries out to Yahweh, to the living God, and trusts in him that her womb is opened. Our God is a God to be trusted. He is, after all, sovereign. He rules over all things. And he is working all things for the good of his people. He's a long-suffering God, so that even when we do the most foolish things and other people may look on and scratch their heads and wonder, why? Why are they doing that? Why are they saying that? How are they thinking that way? Can't they see? No, we can't see. But God is long-suffering. And he brings us eventually to a point where we do see. And he shows compassion towards us. In our weakness, in our sinfulness, in our hurt. He is a God who is worth trusting. And the second response to this God who is compassionate and long-suffering and sovereign is that he is a God to be implored. Since he is compassionate, we take our problems to him. And since he is long-suffering, even though we may realize that we haven't exactly lived the most trustful kind of life, and maybe we will feel in our hearts, well, God won't want anything to do with me now, the long-suffering aspect of the character of God encourages us to still go to him. And the fact that he is sovereign, well, who better to go to? And to unburden ourselves before this one who delights to hear the prayers of his children and from whom every good and perfect gift comes. The unchanging God who is full of compassion, who is long-suffering and sovereign. He is a God to be implored. We mustn't make the mistakes of Leah and Rachel. Plotting and dealing. Trying by our own wisdom and ingenuity to overcome our problems. How easy it is to do that. How natural it is to do that. But a better way is to implore the God who is sovereign. the God who can open and close wombs, the God who can raise and crush nations, the God who can meet us in our needs and provide for us in our needs. He is a God to be implored. Though we must remember that sometimes he takes his time. And sometimes our perception of our needs are not what he knows to be our needs. So as the book of Proverbs says, we must not walk in our own understanding. It's not by our own wisdom, but we must trust in the Lord. The compassionate God, the long-suffering God, the sovereign God, who has worked to effect our salvation by sending his Son into the world and will bring us to glory in his time and by his way. Let us live for him.